So this is joint work with Peter Carr. So the talk is about hedging options on realized variance, and an option on realized variance belongs to a class of contracts called volatility derivatives. These are contracts on, I have in mind contracts on unrealized variance or functions thereof. So they've become popular for any number of reasons. One of them is that portfolio managers want to take views either directional or in a relative value sense. In a directional sense, maybe the user has a view or a forecast based on whatever type of analysis, whether it be time series or macroeconomic or event-driven, that volatility will be higher or lower than the market expects. And then volatility derivatives become a vehicle to express that view. Or it could be in a relative value sense, where the user believes that the market is overpricing the volatility of one index relative to another index, or that the market is over or underpricing the volatility of an index relative to the volatility of the constituent stocks. So you can have long short strategies. In the latter case, it ends up being a play on the correlation of the index's constituent stocks. So that's going to be my one tenuous connection with what Peter had to say in the first talk. That this can be used to express views on correlation. And finally, the user may just be long or short volatility and need to hedge that exposure. The most popular volatility derivative is the variance swap, which just pays realized variance less a fixed leg. So realized variance in practice is defined as a sample standard deviation of, in this case, weekly, but often daily, log returns on the underlying, in this case it's the S&P. There's a floating leg. That's the floating leg, is the sample variance of the underlying on the time period in question. And there's also a fixed leg, and the payout is the positive or negative difference between this floating leg and the fixed leg. For our purposes, we're going to have zero fixed legs, and we're not going to have any notionals. Notional will be unit. It will be just one. All of these issues are easy to deal with. So we think of a variance swap as simply paying realized variance. The fixed leg is trivial. The market for variance swaps has grown sharply over the past 2 years. Volumes expressed in terms of vega notional, approximately $4 to $5 million daily. So that's like $1 billion in annual terms. And unlike a lot of the estimates of the size of the derivatives market, when they're expressed in notional terms, you know that the actual payments changing hands are a small fraction of that notional amount. But in this case, this really is of the order of magnitude of the size of the payments that are actually changing hands, because vega notional means per point of volatility by which the realization differs from the strike, essentially, loosely speaking. So this is, you're not multiplying this by some tiny multiplier. You're really taking $1 billion a year and multiplying it by the number of percentage points of volatility that the realization differs from the strike. So this market is big and growing. They're now the preferred route for many fund managers and proprietary traders to make bets on market volatility. Because they're pure plays on variance. They isolate variance, or they isolate volatility, and take away having to worry about or having to hedge out the directional moves in the underlying. Now, so that's something that you would have to worry about if you were just trying to use options on price, S&P 500 listed options, if you wanted to make a bet on volatility using options on the underlying, would have the disadvantage that you would have to worry about things such as the directional moves. It would not be a pure play on volatility. Now, the issue with variance swaps is that if you're short a variance swap, then in theory your downside is unlimited. So that's what that last quote is getting at. So there's some demand for a different kind of exposure to variance risk, in particular an option on realized variance, whether it's a call or a put, would allow you to go long or short realized variance while tailoring your risk profile. For example, if you want to limit the downside to the premium that you paid for the option, then a way to go might be an option on realized variance. And so this quote here gets at a few different points. One is that there is a demand for such instruments, that a call on variance becomes very liquid when there are enough clients around that the dealer can just cross it between two clients, and the dealers are happy to do that. And there's sufficient demand from clients that allows this to happen sometimes. On the other hand, and that's what the rest of this quote is getting at, the dealer has to keep this contract on their books without being able to immediately lay off the risk on some other client. Well, then it's a different story, because even though the investors, even though the hedge funds and the portfolio managers may want this kind of product, the dealers the dealers are not so willing to write such a product and keep it on their books. The industry is taking big risk writing such products, and at some point it will be a risk that you can't assess. This industry has to fulfill investors' needs, so this is a desired product. However, the dealer's not willing to write a ticking bomb. So what this talk does is then we're going to try to create or replicate or synthesize contracts on realized variance using vanilla options and the underlying shares. We want the replication strategy to be model-free, so not dependent on any specific model of the underlying dynamics. And for the basic contract, the variance swap, we review the known replication strategy. For variance options, it's not possible to replicate perfectly in a model-independent way. That's in contrast to the situation with variance swaps, and part of the reason why variance swaps are so liquidly traded now is because there is a model-independent replication strategy for variance swaps. Variance options is very much an open question, and that's what we're dealing with. But what we can do is super replicate using vanilla options and the underlying. So we can find at least upper bounds on the value of a variance option in terms of vanilla options. Now, we have this other joint work, a paper called Robust Replication of Volatility Derivatives. That took a different approach to contracts on realized variance. In that paper, we made an independence assumption to find perfect replication strategies for a given variance contract. We didn't stop there. We also carefully tailored the replication strategies and the hedging strategies so that they would be first order invariant to the presence of correlation. The correlation that I'm talking about here is correlation between volatility and price. So it does make an independence assumption, and then it immunizes, it chooses the portfolios in such a way that they're immunized against violations of that independence assumption. So it doesn't just stop there, but it does start from an independence assumption. In contrast, in the approach that we're taking here, we drop the independence assumption entirely. We work only under the assumptions of essentially a positive, continuous underlying price process and nothing else. And with such general assumptions, we're not going to be able to pinpoint the price of an option on variance, but what we can do is find upper and lower bounds. That's in contrast to the earlier work, which didn't just find upper and lower bounds, it came up with a price. That price was under a relaxed independence assumption. So we're assuming frictionless arbitrage-free markets, and Y will denote the price of a share of the underlying asset. And I'm assuming Y is a continuous semi-martingale, so it's a local martingale plus a drift term. So all Itô processes, for example, fall into this category, where the drift may be stochastic, and the instantaneous volatility may be stochastic. X will be the log returns process. I'm assuming no dividends. I'm assuming zero interest rates. So the cash or the bond has price one at all times. So I need both notations here, because Y is the thing that you can trade. It's the underlying. Whereas X is the thing whose variance we want to write contracts on. If you go back to that term sheet, you're not taking the daily difference in S, you're taking the daily return on S. So it's the log that we want to write the contract on. Bracket X and bracket Y will denote quadratic variation, which you can think of as the continuously sampled cumulative realized variance of the log process and the price process, respectively. So you can think of this bracket process, it's an increasing process that accumulates from time zero to time t, the increments in the bracket process, and each increment in the bracket process is the square of the increment in the log process. So it's the squared log return from day to day, let's say, except mathematically it's not daily sampling, it's continuous sampling. So that log relationship implies that using Itô's rule, this is the derivative of the log function, there's also a drift term. I don't care about the drift term when I'm computing the variance. It's like dt squared is zero, loosely speaking. So if I want the square of dx, I can ignore this term and just square this term. So that's what I'm doing. So this is a relationship we'll use because, remember, X is the thing whose variance we want to price and to hedge. Y is the thing that we can trade, so we have one in terms of the other now. In the case of the Itô process, the bracket is just the time integral of the instantaneous volatility. So this is what I mean by realized variance, is the bracket X at some fixed time horizon, capital T. A variance swap pays realized variance. So again, we're assuming zero fixed leg, unit notional, no annualization, and continuous sampling. A variance call, which is the thing we want to study and that we want to hedge, with strike Q and expiration capital T, pays realized variance minus the variance strike Q, the positive part. So it's been known since the 90s that you can create the payoff bracket X by holding statically a European style contract that pays you minus 2 times the log return from time 0 to time capital T. And that's something, that's a log function, which doesn't directly exist in the exchanges, but indirectly exists because that log payoff can be decomposed into calls and puts. So for our purposes, we consider that as something that's tradable that you can acquire. In addition, so that's held statically. In addition, there's a dynamic position. The profit or loss from holding 2 over Y shares at each time. So this number of shares is changing dynamically. So you can think of the shares as somehow delta hedging the log contract and removing its directional dependence and leaving only the volatility exposure. Here's the log contract. It looks like it's bearish, but it's not because maybe if you include that share position as well, it becomes clear that it's not bearish. It's just long variance. So if you hold this European style payoff and you adjust the number of shares you hold through time, then in the end your total profit or loss will be exactly the realized variance. That log contract decomposes into 2 over k squared dk calls or puts at each strike k. Which is it? Well, it's whatever's out of the money at that strike. If the strike is out of the money, is an out of money call strike, then hold that many calls, otherwise hold that many puts. So the value of that option portfolio is the replication cost of realized variance, which is a totally model-independent risk-neutral expectation of realized variance, which can therefore be described as a model-free implied variance. Since 2003, the Chicago Board Option Exchange's VIX index has been defined as the square root of that value using S&P options for T equals 30 days after interpolation. So this is a well-accepted concept. Derivation is by Ito's rule, and you just apply Ito's rule to the log, and when you apply Ito's rule to the log, you get a stochastic integral rule with respect to price, which is something that you can get, that you can create by trading the shares, by holding 1 over Y shares. And the second term that you get is exactly what we're looking for. You're getting the variance process. So X itself you can create using vanilla options. So you can create 2 of these things, you can create the third. The only point that I want to add to what's very well accepted is just the fact that I don't need to be restricted to this particular log payoff. I can add any affine function of price, and the resulting contract still has a value equal to the expected realized variance, and still replicates the realized variance using in a self-financing sense, provided that this function is initially at the money. And by at the money, I mean that when you evaluate this function at the time zero price, that you get zero. So in other words, the red curve is the one that I've already shown you. This is today's underlying. So it's well known that red curve can replicate the realized variance if you hold that European style contract. But furthermore, it's pretty easy to show that if you add any affine function, any linear affine function, to that red curve in such a way that the new function still passes through zero at today's stock price, in other words, it's still at the money today, then the red curve, the blue curve, or the green curve, all of them have the same value, and that value is the expectation of realized variance, risk-neutral expectation. So I'm going to use that fact when we talk about how to replicate call on variance. So an option to receive variance less a strike has a similar setup. The only difference is that instead of a payoff that's realized variance minus strike, it's the max of realized variance minus strike and zero. But that introduces a lot of trouble to the dealer who's trying to hedge it. It's nice for a portfolio manager who buys such a product and can tailor their risk exposure more carefully. But to the dealer, there are difficulties that arise from the absence of a model-independent strategy to replicate variance options using Europeans and the underlying Y. But we'll find model-independent strategies to super-replicate. So if the variance option is bid above our upper bound, then you can short that variance option and go long our super-replicating strategy and thereby produce model-free arbitrage. Here's the general strategy. We're going to introduce a double barrier in price space, BD and BU, where BD is below the initial level of the underlying. BU is above the initial level of the underlying. And we'll let tau B be the passage time to that barrier. And then we're going to decompose the payout of the call on variance into two pieces, which together will sum to more than the payout of that call. The first piece is a call on the pre-barrier variance, on the amount of variance that's accumulated from time zero until the barrier is hit. The second piece is all of the post-barrier variance, so all of the variance that occurs after the barrier is hit. And adding those two together gives you something that's bigger than a call on the total variance. So if this is the initial price, I'm going to put BU here, BD there, and there's some variance until it hits the barrier. This is the expiration T. This is time zero. Then after the barrier, there's more variance. So a call on the total variance is smaller than a call on the blue variance plus all of the red variance. And likewise, for the down barrier. Of course, if the barrier is not hit, it could all be blue variance. So this may seem like I've just complicated the problem for no reason. I mean, it's hard enough to get a call on variance to date T. Now I'm telling you, no, let's look at a call on variance to a particular to a particular price barrier. But as we'll see, a call on variance to a particular price barrier is a lot easier to deal with than a call on variance to a particular calendar time. So let me actually skip so I'm going to skip the actual calculations that do this and just explain in sort of hand-waving fashion the idea. So first let me replicate the red variance. So I want all of the variance from the time when the barrier is hit until the expiration date. And from what we just saw, we can do that as long as I have a log contract plus some linear affine function, which is at the money at initiation. So initiation at the top barrier is at BU. So as long as you have a log contract plus a constant times price plus another constant, which is at the money at the up barrier, then when you hit the up barrier, that log contract will have the correct value and will have you correctly positioned that you can perfectly replicate the remaining variance by trading in the shares. But the share trading doesn't get introduced until you're actually there. But we need a log contract that's at the money, both at the up barrier and at the down barrier, because we don't know which barrier it's going to hit, so we need to be in a position to replicate the remaining variance, whether we've hit the up barrier or whether we've hit the down barrier. But that's fine, because we've got two constraints and two parameters that we can solve for. And this is just a linear system. So as long as we make sure that at both the down barrier and the up barrier, that the log contract is at the money, this horizontal line is the zero line, then as long as we hold this contract to begin with, then I know that whether we hit the down barrier or whether we hit the up barrier, that when we hit the barrier, we're exactly correctly positioned to replicate the remaining red variance. The only issue is that, well, what if it takes that path that never hits the barrier? If it's all blue, and if it expires without hitting one barrier or the other, well then we have this obligation here. We have a liability, which we don't want. So what we can do is take the positive part and hold the red payoff instead, and that'll super replicate. We can do a little bit better than this, but for now let's just cut off the negative part and make sure that we hold something that's always non-negative. So that takes care of the red variance. So what about the blue variance? What about the call on the blue variance? So in other words, this piece and this piece and this piece. Well, I claim that a call on the amount of variance that that is elapsed from time zero until the time that you hit a barrier. Is easy to price for this reason. If we think of the process, and this is a generic process, I haven't told you anything about its dynamics, but there's a general theorem by Dambus, Dubins, and Schwartz that says that any continuous martingale is a Brownian motion if you rescale the time axis. If you make the time stochastic and you introduce a new clock, which we call business time, let's say, and that if you let that clock run faster when there's a lot of activity in the underlying, and if you let that clock run slower when there's only a little bit of activity in the underlying, then the underlying relative to that clock is a Brownian motion. And that clock, to make that a Brownian motion, that clock specifically should be precisely the bracket process. So if you use realized variance as the time scale, then relative to that time scale, this arbitrary price process becomes a Brownian motion. Every continuous driftless process is a Brownian motion run on the stochastic clock. And that clock is precisely the realized variance of this price process, and it runs faster when M is more volatile, slower if it's less volatile. Now, actually, we're dealing with a positive price process, so what we can actually do is something more relevant for our purposes, because what we care about is not the variance of the price, but rather the variance of the log. So we can easily apply Dambus, Dubin, and Schwartz to derive the fact that our price process is driftless geometric Brownian motion with respect to the business time clock, which is not the variance of the price, but rather geometric Brownian motion when you view it relative to a clock, which is the variance of the log price, which is the thing that we're writing the contract on. So in other words, the expectation of an arbitrary function of the amount of variance until our arbitrary price process hits that barrier is the same thing, is equal to that function, to the expectation of that same function. So G you think of as a call payoff. In our case, it's a call payoff. Applied to the time until unit volatility, driftless geometric Brownian motion hits that barrier. And that's something that we have an explicit formula for, because the first passage density is known for geometric Brownian motion. So, I mean, so in effect, to price a call on the amount of variance until price hits a barrier, you just take the passage time density for geometric Brownian motion to that barrier, and you integrate it against, say, the call payoff that you want to price. And that then explicitly or semi-explicitly computes the desired expectation. So G equals call payoff. Integrate the product of that density with the call payoff. So by the way, if you try to use this trick, if you try to use this trick to create functions of price when the business time hits some threshold, You know, if you try to do this try to hedge or to price European options, you run into the issue that, well, contracts in real life don't expire, well, for the most part, they don't expire at a particular business time. They expire at a particular calendar time. If they expire at a particular business time, then no matter what kind of continuous price process generated the underlying dynamics, you would be able to create general European-style payoffs perfectly by doing Black-Scholes hedges with respect to business time, even though we haven't assumed anything about geometric Brownian motion being the actual process that drives the price. Of course, the problem with that is that if the you know, business time 10 is a random time relative to calendar time, whereas the actual European-style contract expires at a fixed calendar time, this trick lets you hedge things that expire at a random time that depends on how much variance has been accumulated. Now, such contracts actually have been introduced. One bank calls them timer options, and another bank calls them variance-adjusted options. But for the most part, this won't help you hedge a European-style option. It does help us hedge a contract on the amount of variance until price hits a barrier, because no matter how you deform time in a random way, those barriers stay in the same place, right? That those are horizontal barriers, which are invariant to any kind of time deformation. So we can easily do an arbitrary function of the variance until you hit the barrier. And in particular, a call on the variance until you hit a barrier. For the double barrier case, it turns out that the passage time density is really messy. But what is known is the Laplace transform of that density. And so it turns out to be a lot easier to write it in terms of inverting a Fourier Laplace transform instead of actually multiplying a density by a payoff function. And essentially, if you know the Laplace transform of the pricing density, then it's game over, really, as far as pricing any option, because there's methods, including some in an earlier paper of mine, that immediately go from the Laplace transform to call prices, let's say. So the combined super hedge consists of a function that looks like this. Well, so the combined super hedge, again, consists of a function that looks like this, plus, so this is for the post barrier variance, combined with an amount of cash that you need to start you off replicating the call on pre-barrier variance. The call on pre-barrier variance, the hedging strategy for that, we know what its initial value is. The hedging strategy for that does not involve options at all. It just involves starting with a certain amount of cash, namely the expectation given by this integral. That's the amount of cash you start with. And then we have a formula for the number of shares you hold, such that the amount of initial cash in a self-financing way ends up matching the random payoff of the call on pre-barrier variance. So you can think of then, you can combine then the two pieces of that that strategy, the post-barrier piece and the pre-barrier piece. The pre-barrier piece you can just think of as a, because it's cash to begin with, you can just think of this as a parallel shift up of the this European-style payoff. So the only issue then is, where do you put the barriers? Well, any barriers, any two barriers above and below the spot will create a valid upper bound. By optimizing over all possible barrier locations, you can sharpen that, that upper bound. And the thing that you're optimizing is the value of the call on pre-barrier variance, and that's an explicit formula that doesn't require market data. The other piece is the value of the contract that looks like that, where this is the down barrier and that's the up barrier. And that does require a that does require you to look at market data to determine from call and put prices what's the value of this kind of contract. But with the market data together with the explicit formula, you can search over all of the possible down barriers and up barriers and optimize that bound. So what I've drawn here is three different universal super replicating portfolios, which correspond to different choices of the down barrier and up barrier. So one part that I have to skip was that instead of using contracts that look like this, we could actually improve it. It's somehow not necessary to completely remove the negativity in the middle. We can afford to include a little bit of negativity and still come up with a valid upper bound. So that's why you see the horizontal pieces here are curved and not straight. But depending on how you choose the lower and upper barrier, each one of these is purely analytic. I mean, it's a purely analytic computation to come up with each of these curves. Furthermore, each one of these three payoff functions universally super replicates a variance call with strike 0.4. If the strike changed, then we would need different super replicating portfolios. But the black curve model independently and universally for all continuous positive price processes super replicates a variance call starting assuming that the price starts at 100. The same is true of the blue curve and the same is true of the red curve. All of them are universally valid. However, we cannot say universally which one of them is the cheapest and which one of them is the best upper bound. Which one of them is the cheapest would depend on the market prices of calls and puts. But that's something that's in principle it's directly doable using market data on calls and puts of all strikes. So the last picture I want to show is the following. Let's just take a look at the upper and lower bounds. I didn't talk about the lower bounds at all today. I just talked about the upper bounds. But let's take these Heston dynamics. And these Heston dynamics for variance generate prices of calls on variance. So the horizontal axis here is the strike of the variance call. It's what I call the Q. So, I mean, as you might expect, as the strike increases, the price of the variance call decreases under these dynamics. With a strike of zero, the price of the variance call is the same thing as the variance swap. Now, blind to these dynamics and looking only at the European prices generated by these dynamics, let's apply our upper bound and compare it to the prices generated by the Heston dynamics. Now, the European options alone don't determine the distribution of realized variance. So we're not going to be able to nail that down exactly. The best we can do is to come up with a range of prices for the variance call, and this is what we come up with. At the small strikes, everything converges to the price of the variance swap. A particular strike that I want to focus on would be this strike. This strike is the 0.04 strike, and that's the at-the-money strike in the sense that the expected value of variance is 0.04. So that can be considered to be the at-the-money variance call. Yeah. Right, so the W1 is the Brownian motion that drives the price process. And the W1, the correlation between W1 and W2 has no impact on the black curve. But if I change that correlation, I would change the prices of Europeans, and thereby I would change the location of that top curve and the bottom curve. So for that particular strike, it turns out that the Heston price is about 42% of our upper bound. Now you might think that these are that this is a pretty bad upper bound, but I mean my response to that is number one, that well, if all you're given is European option prices, there's going to be a range of a variance call prices consistent with that set of European prices. And, you know, being able to see that a range is wide or narrow gives you information in and of itself, to the extent that it becomes some kind of indicator of the model risk that you assume when you use any particular model that's calibrated to Europeans in pricing the variance options. Another comment I'll make is that as time goes on and variance gets accumulated, effectively that's the same thing as decreasing the effective strike of the variance option. And as the strike goes to zero, we see that the bounds become tighter and tighter. So I'm going to conclude here by saying that we can exactly replicate functions of pre-barrier variance, which by the Dambus-Dubus-Schwartz equivalence has the same law, the same distribution as time until unit volatility geometric Brownian motion hits a barrier, which is well understood. We super replicate post barrier variance, hence we can super replicate variance call, and these bounds can be enforced by explicit model independent trading strategies which give explicit arbitrage if our bounds are violated. So I'll stop there.